wanted to ask you, because he's usually in the hangout where we went, and Thomas is after class, so after work I went in there, and she introduced me, and I asked him, you know, are you going to have the kids do this? And he said, no, I don't think so. That was it.
Sure, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, she said, I'm not going to do that.
So I got off to this car.
You gave the right answer.
Yeah, I think the next time I saw him was at the alumni Thanksgiving event. We had a, it was kind of a fundraiser so that we could put on our all-school, all-class alumni in the spring. We had a banquet and a dance and speaker. And I was the secretary, and this classmate of mine was the president. And we were buddies, and we went up together. And
the classmate of male?
Yeah. And so
the competition.
Yeah, I went with Chucky to the dance, and he was flirting around.
Chucky was kind of strange.
He never married.
He wasn't in a men's club. Part of the men.
But he had graduated from Berea, Baltimore College, and he had to see that everybody had a good time. He was kind of Joe College, you know. So I was sitting with his mother and some other people, and he asked, so Ben came up and asked me to dance. I don't know why he got the idea, who I thought he should. But
oh, you were so beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
Ben, you've been talking about all these years.
So he was a good dancer, so we danced most of the evening. And we came out, and I remember Daniel's little brother, said, oh, we're having a group out to the house. I think, well, he was still living at home then. I think he was just out of the service or something.
Grissinger's,
yeah. And he said, come on out to the house, Chucky, and you and Shirley. And Chucky says, well, I don't know. He didn't know whether he was going to take me home or not.
How many years ago is that?
No, 54. We were married in 52.
You remember it pretty clearly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, old people remember things in the past better than yesterday.
I have a feeling you two remember yesterday pretty clearly.
I don't know.
So I remember dates at the POW, you know. Pretty close.
Yeah, I don't have the calendars.
Did you think it would be important to have that information available to report after the war? Is that why you kept it? Not as a history?
I didn't ask the future plan. Well, I just remembered
it. I think they just went day to day.
Yeah, you think the best of the day. That's what I always said. I lived day to day and made the best of the day. For 1,244 days.
I asked you once before, Ben, what you thought about war crime trials for the Japanese.
I don't know that they did all that much good. They executed a lot of guards, generals, bowmen, yamashita. I wouldn't want to be accused of guard of having executed just because it's treated us. It's war time. How do you make rules about war? I don't think it's possible. You know, you have to kill each other. Otherwise, you wouldn't start the war.
Did you have, pretty hard to make rules about war. Did you have residual anger against the Japanese because of, even after you were released? How did you get through that?
Well, I used to be very, I hated it, you know. And, you know, after I taught, I used to have Japanese students, and they kind of helped me get over that. I bet your dad had no problem, didn't he?
No, my dad said he never really did have problems.
Didn't he?
No, he didn't. I don't know why. But what was that like the first time that you had a Japanese student in your class?
Well, the first one I had, I said, I don't know how to handle it, you know.
Yeah.
I said, well, I've got a treaty, you know, like you're a boy, you know.
Sure.
Which I did, and I had a kind of a Japanese apartment.
Oh, damn, yeah.
Koya.
Mm-hmm.
So he was American born.
Yeah, you know. Get together, and I had several others that went, one gal went out and took them, lived here. And there's one little gal here that was in the same village as Tacoma. But she won't come out here. I tried to get Michiko to say, bring her out here someday. I might talk to her. But she won't come.
I think she might now, Michiko says. But she didn't come over here until fairly recently. You know, and she was getting used to the culture and everything.
But what she remembered about is how black we were. We were coming out of the mine, you know, full of folder. I'd like to talk to her.
And she lives here now? In the room?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Michiko Conklin, she married a serviceman after the war and went to White Sulphur Springs where he was an attorney. And he died fairly young, so she raised her kids and then she came to college at Eastern and studied under Ben. And she has a studio in that Rue Baptiste on Montana Avenue. She looks really, she's very talented. And we see her all the time. We had another Michiko before that, when we first came.
That was Yoko Miso.
Yeah, Michiko Yoko Miso. She was from...
She married a guy by the name of Anderson.
She's an architect.
Which is quite a compliment.
Yeah. She's an architect.
Yeah, anyway.
We heard in Toronto, I think.
Yeah.
But she was right out of Japan, and he got all her credits from these different, she'd been to school in Washington State and then in Japan, so that she could get her BA, and then she went on to, I think, the University of Washington in architecture. But and she was so appreciative, you know, that he got all her things organized for her, and she used to come out to the house. We had her for dinner.
She had her mother make kimonos.
Yeah.
I never
did wear it. No way. He came to Studio Theater.
He came to the Studio Theater.
She was,
you know.
It was very nice of her.
Huh? That's because we get caught in. So tell us, how did you go from high school art teacher and football and basketball coach without losing a game to teaching at Eastern now, MSU Billing?
Well, you got your answer.
Well, that was before I was gone to grad school. After I got out of graduate school, I went to work for the Department of Army, and I worked for 6 years. Doing what? I was a craft director for the military.
What is
that? Hobby shops and stuff, you know?
Setting them out
of special services. Fort Riley, Kansas, and I built shops there, woodworking shops, photography, and all that. Recreation facilities. Then I got a job as staff craft director for the Military District of Washington, D.C. So I went there for a couple of years.
And all the shops for
shops around Washington, all the missile sites and everything.
And Fort Churchill, Canada.
Then I took a job at Third Army Headquarters. I was a staff craft director.
Atlanta.
And all I did was inspect shops and everything. And I was all the way back in a week dock time over there and set up shops with the Department of Army. But I got kind of tired of politics and living out of the city page, you know, and flew around a lot.
And were you a civilian now, or were you a civilian working for the Department of Army?
I served at the GS. And, so I came out here 1 year and I decided I'd go and ask him for a job. And I went up and talked to President Easton and he put me on.
Well, he just built the PE building and he wanted murals and he had his portfolio mural that he did for his master's at DU, which was a huge, the whole wall. Art to the West, it was a rodeo, and the movement went like this, and so Herb Steele was the president. He saw that and he wanted a mural, and he hired him on the spot.
Well, I painted those big murals today. Mm-hmm. Have you seen them?
I'm not.
Sure, we have.
Feet up there.
Oh, yes, we have. In the back where they play basketball.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we've seen them before.
Yeah. No, on each side of them, when you come in, there's two of them. They're 26 feet of feet.
Well, at least I have, I guess.
They're 8
temper. I don't know. I tell about those. I went to a basketball game up there one day, and during the halftime, we're out in the lobby of that, and there's some guy from North Dakota.
Uh-oh.
He says, those have to be the ugliest teams
I ever
seen.
To you?
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry you feel that way. I said, I'm the one who feels that way. No. Well, I took my driver's license out, you know, and I said, he was so embarrassed. And he was so embarrassed. He just got red in the face and finally went back into the gym. I really got to him there. I said, you told me the truth the first time. Don't try to apologize.
Well, they're very stylized.
I like them, some don't.
They're stylized. You know, with the pointy head and all the motion and stuff. So, I don't think he did any art that was not the only representation, really.
For all the people who say that.
That's what he was thinking, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's what he was thinking.
Oh, boy. He could have dug a hole right there in the floor.
Oh, that's too funny. Well, can you think of anything else, Chris?
I know one of the questions Shen has asked other vets is there some item, lucky piece, charm, physical thing that you kept with you during the war? Did you have something like that? I brought myself back then.
You were your lucky piece.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, everything was taken away.
Really,
right.
Anything. A lot of guys brought their own mess kits out and everything. I never did. I remember Porky Dillon.
Oh, that roll.
He brought one of the soybean buns that he kept.
It was like a petrified rock.
Yeah. It was still just as solid as a rock after a couple of years.
Did you value that, you know?
Yeah,
you kept it.
You could drop it on the floor and it wouldn't
just break your toe.
It was made out of this soybean flour and water.
You could have made
tactics out of soybeans, you know. Well, we used to issue those for a while. That's what we got to eat.
In the Philippines or
in the
Japan?
We'd get a 2 for breakfast and 1 for lunch or something.
Were you fed better there than 15?
Not here.
Oh.
No, we existed all the way through.
Yeah.
You know, toward the end of the war, we were on this really bad rations. They kept cutting our rations, you know, up until it was rendered. So we were on just existing.
Well, the whole country was rationed. I mean,
they dropped us that food on the island, and it was a big celebration.
Did you get sick from eating food like that after? Yeah.
I ate a whole box of candy bars. I got sick of
them. Of course. Was that your Milky Way pie? That was your Milky Way pie?
Yeah, my Milky Way pie. I forget. I call them iMac, but I've never heard of an iMac candy bar.
I don't know what they were.
They were some kind of a candy bar.
I don't remember anything.
They were awfully good, I know. Threw them up, and then I got into some bacon.
Oh.
And I made me sick again, all I could reach, you know.
Yeah.
I finally settled down, and we got some fruit and that sort of thing. Started some of that K-ration. So we got
way more balance.
I got on the food, you know, and I came to know I gained 30 pounds for that, for sure. Most of the guys, it was pretty good, you know. Okay.
somebody said, you don't look too bad to me, and I said, yeah, I am. It was the same thing about to go. Yeah. Everybody gained weight like that. And you just see them blow up.
They didn't have any muscle bone.
Yeah.
Then I've seen lots of your different kinds of paintings and drawings, some in Lewistown where you have your POW work and Roundup where you have oils, watercolors, and comical drawings of Montana cowboys and real men, and other displays around Billings. And so many different styles, and some of it pastoral and some of it comical, but you're still painting pieces about the war experience. Why do you continue to paint about the war
experience? I just do what comes to my head, you know. I'm this guy that's writing a book, he's got all my sketchbooks, and he says, there's guards all the way through the boat, you know, and I said, well, those guards are impressive. So I still keep doing them. I get in a sketchbook and I'll just do something, you know, like that. I've done those sort of cartoons, you know, that sort of stuff. I've experimented a lot there. And I've gone through abstract, I've done abstract, you know, I've done.
It's a big one.
Huh?
Oh. I don't know. There you have it.
Oh, turn it around. I'm going to look for that one, the spirit of modernism.
Oh, I think they're coming up in the closet.
I'm showing something like contemporary stuff. I think you're abstract.
When did you do that?
Oh, it's not the mission. I kind of scrolled on that one time, but I thought, yeah, but the curator said that might have been steel.
Is she from North Dakota?
Well, here to modernism, but I'm in here. You wouldn't believe what I did in Oklahoma. Amazing.
Wow.
Fine. This is,
I love those colors.
If you're from California on that, I just they love it.
Well, I can see why. That's a different Ben Seal.
Yeah, yeah.
There are a lot of different Ben Seals.
I got that there with a 3-inch house brush.
My.
How big is it?
That's 6 feet.
Okay.
I think it's 5 by 6. Oh, yeah, there's 6 feet by 48.
And when did you do that? 1968.
My goodness.
Were you at MSCB then?
No, I was at Montana State. I went to school there one summer.
Oh.
Well, yeah. And, they were all
teaching Northeastern.
And in fact, I said, well, I can do one of those, you know, and I got a direction with that.
That's pretty cool. The colors are really nice. Yeah, they are. Even in here, they're nice.
Corals and teals and
aquas.
Well, what's so interesting to me is that you don't pigeonhole yourself. You don't get into some comfort zone and stay there because this is what you know and
I
think this is what
works. I've done it all.
And you're not afraid to have somebody say, oh, that's the worst
painting.
Well,
yeah. I think the Cleveland School, I think they had you doing all different.
Well, we did everything there. You know, I have a very strong background in design. It was a good school.
Excellent.
They touch out of your.
Don't you think that you've gotten better as an artist? I mean, you have reached a point where you've stopped getting better. Do you think
I don't think I'm getting much better anymore
without it. Well, I've seen the things that you're working on in your studio. I don't know when those all began, but wow.
Well, he...
Well, I've done it all the way from forfeiture, you know, dukes and stuff like that.
The war oil, I think he does. He didn't do for years, but if he wants to fill in for the museum, I think.
Yeah. I think that was exquisite paint. Yeah. And the reason I asked you about still doing that work, to get that kind of emotion in the picture must take a lot of emotional commitment from you, and that has to be a hard, dark place to go to.
I kind of want to like them. They're kind of expressions of passion.
Yeah, oh, I see it. I see it in the image, yes.
Whether I'm doing a Western or whether I'm doing something in the war. You know, I don't suffer when I do those war things. They're in my mind, you know. So I can... I just put them on a paper like that.
Is it still therapy, do you think? Is it still therapy?
Oh, yeah. Art's a great therapy. I think it helped me to readjust myself. It helped me to... It enriched my life, you know.
You've got to be one of the only, maybe the only, artist chronicler of that experience.
Well, I'm the only one I know of that came out of there.
Do you think that you got special responsibility then?
Well, you kind of take it as a responsibility because I know how to do this, so I should read.
Future college expenses. The other option you have is to take the money out yourself and use it for other purposes, whatever that may be, but that's where you would pay income tax and penalty on the earnings. A third choice is simply to do nothing, let the funds continue to accumulate in that account, and at some point in the future decide what you want to do. And perhaps a grandchild will come along at some time and you can change the beneficiary to that grandchild.
When is a Coverdell Education IRA a preferable choice over a 529 plan?
The Coverdell is similar to the 529 plan in that it also offers tax-free investing for college. The Coverdell goes one step further and also can be used tax-free for elementary and secondary school expenses. So families that might be sending their child to private grade school really should look to the Coverdell account first, I think, before they look at the 529s. These are not state-sponsored programs. You're not going to get any particular state income tax benefits that you might get with a 529 plan. And also, the Coverdell is more restricted. You can put in a total of $2,000 per child per year into a Coverdell account, as opposed to tens of thousands or potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars that you can put into a 529 plan. And there are some age restrictions on the Coverdell account, but if you're in a position to put away a couple thousand dollars per year for your child, I would certainly consider the Coverdell Education Savings Account as an alternative to the 529.
529 plans haven't been around for a long time and are still evolving. What are the biggest changes do you see coming down the road?
The biggest thing to watch out for is that the law which exempts your earnings from a 529 plan and you use the money for college expires at the end of 2010. And starting in 2011, if nothing has changed, then those distributions are no longer tax-free, but instead the earnings would be taxable to your beneficiary.
We'll look back to your 2010, certainly before then, but we'll definitely be checking in at that time. And thank you very much. My pleasure.
Joseph Hurley is the author of The Best Way to Save for College, A Complete Guide to 529 Plans. You can find information about your state's 529 plan on his website, savingforcollege.com. While we at Sound Money always recommend a diverse portfolio, we tend to think of investing in bonds when the market is down or rates are low, because it's usually a safe place to put our money. But with evidence that we're heading out of a recession and the likelihood that the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates in the next year, you're probably thinking bonds are less attractive. But there is one type of bond that can perform well at times like this, high-yield bonds. These aren't your classic safe to fixed income securities. High yields are better known by another name, junk bonds. As with stocks, you take a greater risk with junk bonds. So are they worth more than their name suggests? Let's ask our own in-house investment expert, Erica Whitmer. Hi, Erica.
Hi, Stephanie.
So when you invest in bonds, what you're doing is loaning money to a company or the government so they can use it and then pay you interest on it. What's different with junk bonds?
Well, bonds, like people, have credit ratings. So at one end, in the people analogy, you've got a nice, safe, secure first mortgage on a home. At the other end, you've got a loan shark in a dark alley in a trench coat. And junk bonds are bonds of companies that have fallen from grace or never got into grace and have low ratings. They're called below investment grade bonds. Investment grade bonds are the higher rated bonds, and many fiduciaries like trust companies and pension plans and so on are limited or unable to invest in below investment grade bonds. But thanks to Michael Milken, we now have this wonderful flourishing market in these lower grade bonds. Some of these companies are fallen angels, so they've just, you know, messed up. Some have made some missteps or had financial problems. Some are smaller firms or in riskier industries where they just have to pay more to borrow money. So there's a lot of different ways a company can get to junk status. Erica, junk bonds have been the weakest part of the bond sector in the past couple of years, but a lot of analysts are saying that junk bonds perform well when we're coming out of a recession. So they might make a good bet right now. What do you think?
Well, back in 1991, when we were coming out of the recession, junk bonds went up 37% in 1 year.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
And that halo is still there, needless to say. But at the same time, interest rates were falling. So that was an extraordinary time for this particular type of investment. But they have this aura of doing well when the economy is picking up, because the companies that are on shaky ground will get more solid as the economy improve. So that's the whole concept behind investing in them when the economy is starting into a recovery. On the other hand, though, interest rates are going up now, will be going up. So that's not a good time to invest in bonds of any kind.
Are these riskier stocks?
They bounce around a lot, and yes, they certainly can be. When it comes to junk bonds, the default rate on them usually runs about 3-5%, meaning they're gone. Right now it's running about 10%, and that's because of the big telecom bust, because a lot of those telecom companies that are going belly up now, whose stocks are in the basement, just issued billions of dollars worth of debt.
Mm-hmm.
Another category is the energy companies that have really gotten hurt by the Enron and the fallout from that. So right now we're seeing good yields on junk bonds, but you've also got a lot of risk because some of these companies are not going to make it. Think Global Crossing and Enron and Kmart. The other end of the spectrum is there are some telecom companies like AT&T that aren't quite to junk bond status, but are giving junk bond yields right now.
So then there are managers who go out and look for those kinds of things. They stick with the high quality end of the joke in America.
Or the lower quality.
It does. Or the lower. But remember, this is all graded. You know, it's just AAA, AA, and so on. They're all graded. It's just like school. So bonds have ratings. You know, the bond market is more rational and efficient. And so you kind of get what you pay for. If you buy a bond that's yielding 29%, the odds of that company going belly up are extremely high. If someone decides that junk bonds are for them, how much of your portfolio should be in junk bonds? And how do you get invested in junk bonds? Do you just go out and buy them around? Especially this week only. I would say to put no more than 10, tops 20% of your bond portfolio, of your bond money, into junk bonds.
Like everybody, that's not 10 to 20% of your portfolio,
right.
Just bond portfolio.
Right. And realize that you're going to have to live with a lot of volatility. And you do not want to buy yield, and that's why people get attracted to junk bonds. Last year, for example, junk bonds yielded 10.5%.
Whew,
sounds good. Not too shabby, but the total return was 1.8%. Meaning the bonds went down about 9% in value during the year. So they bounce around a lot in price, and it is not just related to interest rates as it is like with government, with federal bonds. So you've really got to keep in mind not to buy yield. Look for a company with a good solid track record and a good solid manager. You want a more conservative junk bond fund, again, one that invests in the higher quality, bonds, rather than the ones that are in default and really in the basement. Thanks a lot, Erica.
You're welcome.
Erica Whitmer is an investment expert with nearly 18 years of experience in the financial world. Still ahead, is putting your trust in big business putting you at risk?
This isn't about showing your loyalty and faith in the company. It's about avoiding a foolish and dangerous lack of diversification.
And we'll find out what's on your mind when Chris Farrell takes your questions next on Sound Money. You're listening to Sound Money, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Sound Money is supported by the Barron's, Bozeman, and Sheridan offices of U.S. Bank Corp. Piper Jaffray, offering a variety of investment choices, including stocks, tax-free municipal bonds, CDs, and government-guaranteed securities.
Some predict computers will someday be able to outthink and outperform humans. To ensure this doesn't happen, some scientists are using chip implants and high-tech mechanical parts.
The cyborg is really a case of saying, well, if you can't beat intelligent robots, let's join them, almost become the same.
I'm Steve Kerr with Cyborgs. Tune in to part 3 of the Living on Earth series, Generation Next, Remaking the Human Race, on NPR.
Join us Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock. This is Sound Money, a program devoted to helping you make sound decisions about your financial future. I'm Stephanie Curtis. It's time for your calls now. Chris Farrell, our Economic Settlement Chief Correspondent, is here with you. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
And he is ready and waiting for you to call. So if you have a question, call us at 1-800-537-5252, or you can send us an email at mail@soundmoney.org. Peter's on the line now. He's a business student, and he's got a question. Hey, Peter.
Hi. I was just curious if you could dispel or possibly back up the kind of myth of the stock market always going south in the summer, and for various reasons, vacations, and people just paying less attention to that.
The Hampton effect. Wall Street goes out to the Hamptons. Economists have been fascinated by the calendar effect for years, and we've found out that January is typically the best month for stocks, and September is the worst, and there's the end of the month effect, and the end of the week effect, and the January effect, which, you know, no one's quite sure why, and we do these international studies. When you go through it, there's a couple of things. It's not consistent enough to base any investment strategy on. Secondly, if you try to, commission costs would eat up whatever gain that you have. And the third thing is, right now at a period of time when the economy is getting stronger, but the market's getting weaker, and there's a strange divergence, but corporate profits are improving, and you could easily see, because of the business cycle, a snapback during the summer, and people would cancel their vacations right away. So I'm always a skeptic, and always have been a skeptic, that seasonal effects are consistent enough to be real, because whenever people tear apart the numbers, they always come up with some different quarter as the best quarter to be investing in, and it's not always the summer. And secondly, even if it was real, or even if there is some rhythm to the Wall Street market tied to the moon rising, the moon falling, or the warm days being here as opposed to the cold days, no one can make money off it.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Peter.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Kathy is on the line. She's calling from Fort Pierce, Florida. And Kathy, you have some money and some CDs, and you're wondering what to do with it.
Hi. Yeah, I had $18,000 as a severance pay from a job, and I put $15,000 of it in CDs, a 6-month and a 12-month. We're starting a small business, so I wanted the liquidity of the CDs. But now we've sold the business, and I'm just wondering if there's a better place for this money.
Well, there's nothing wrong with certificates of deposit. I mean, they're boring. They're not really great. But you could compare CDs, certificates of deposit, to what you could get on, you know, six-month U.S. Treasury. And after taxes, which when you come out ahead, or putting the money into a money market mutual fund. So I think a CD is perfectly fine for the fixed income portion of your portfolio. If you'd like to keep that as an anchor, stay with the CDs. There's really nothing wrong with it. The bigger question is taking a look at your overall portfolio, you know, how much you have in retirement savings, where that money in retirement savings is invested, this money that you have in the CDs, and how many emergency savings you have. And there's a very useful exercise all of us should do. And it's one of those exercises that's really easy to avoid, but it's taking a look at all your money and getting rid of the categories, and just sort of put it all in a pot. And sort of look at, where is your money? How much of your portfolio is in stocks? How much of your portfolio is in fixed income securities like CDs? How much of your portfolio is in that checking account or that savings account? And then see if you like where everything is, and then you might want to do a little moving around. But that's the way you can make a very sensible judgment, is when you sort of just look at the overall portfolio, see how this household firm, you mentioned a small business, but really you're running a household firm, how are the finances of your household firm?
We're above water so far.
Okay, well, good. But I would seriously, just as, and then you directly answer the specifics of your question, take a look at U.S. Treasuries. You can buy them directly from the U.S. government, from the U.S. Treasury at treasurydirect.gov. Often you come out ahead of CDs after taxes with U.S. Treasuries. Not always, but often.
Oh, okay.
Thanks for coming,
Thank you.
If you want to talk to Chris, give us a call at 1-800-537-5252, or you can send us an email at mail@soundmoney.org. Libby's on the line. Libby is looking for some information about health insurance. Hi, Libby.
Hi. This is a great service and a great chance to ask a complicated question. How does one determine whether or not it's wise to buy long-term care insurance?
Well, this is the question of the era, and it's a question we're going to all be asking ourselves maybe over the next couple of years, because there are two people that shouldn't buy long-term care insurance, and then there's the rest of us lumped in the middle. If you're extremely wealthy, you probably don't need long-term care insurance because you can self-insure. And if you don't have a lot of money, you don't have a lot of assets, and you're not putting money into a 401k, you know, there's no reason to buy long-term care insurance because you'll come under Medicaid at some point. It's the vast middle that is muddling through this issue. And it is complicated, as you mentioned, because there's all kinds of things to consider. It's cheaper if you buy the premiums when you're younger, but then you have to pay those premiums. And so it adds up to a lot of money, and the premiums are not cheap. The product keeps changing. Some of the major issuers of long-term care insurance have gotten into financial trouble. Well, who wants to be buying a product from a company that doesn't have a blue-chip balance sheet? So what I can say to you is that it is going to take some research. If your employer or if you have a partner and their employer offers it through work, that's one of the best ways to buy it. The best write-up for the individual will be what I've seen on ways to think about long-term care insurance and what might be some alternatives, such as taking out a reverse mortgage or relying on your children and your family rather than paying the insurance, is by Jane Brown Quinn in her book, Making the Most of Your Money, which has recently been reissued. It's a very nice discussion. The Health Insurance Association of America at HIAA.org is an industry group, but it gives you a pretty nice discussion about what current premium payments are, how to think about premium payments, and there are a number of things you really have to look at very carefully. Inflation. How do we deal with inflation? When does it kick in? Does it kick in fairly quickly, or does it take a long period of time for the long-term care insurance to kick in? So those are at least some things that I can say to think about this complicated product.
Do you sense that the 5% compounded inflation is an essential component?
Yes. I really do. I think that's the thing. Right now, we're in a low inflation environment, and as I've pronounced many times on the show, well, I'm an inflation optimist. But two things. I'm not an inflation optimist when it comes to healthcare. I think we're seeing that right now where the premium increases for this coming year are running around 20%. You really need that inflation protection in this product. Otherwise, it's not worth buying.
Thanks, Libby.
Thank you very much.
And I want to mention we'll be having a show about long-term care insurance coming in July. Eric is concerned about the events in the Middle East and the security of his money. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Stephanie. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
I'm a very cautious investor, and in light of the growing turmoil around the globe, I've moved my capital to the sidelines, and most of it is in a Schwab money market fund. Okay. I understand that that's not as secure or guaranteed like a bank savings account would be, but I'm wondering what would happen to that in the event of a crisis. And in addition, what kind of recommendations would you have for a cautious investor? I know you're a huge proponent of I-bonds.
Okay. In terms of the money market mutual fund, it's very true that it is not as secure or safe as the money that you put in the bank, so long as you're under $100,000 in the bank, because they have the full faith and credit of the federal government backing the $100,000, which now it seems a move in Congress to raise it to $130,000, and it looks like that will become law. However, all your blue chip financial services companies like a Charles Schwab have so far dedicated themselves that their money market mutual funds will never break a buck. That's what we call it, break the buck, the principal value that you put in there. And they'll put reserves in and money in from elsewhere if there is a risk of breaking the buck. My own guess is that it's a very well-diversified portfolio in this money market mutual fund. They own a lot of securities, including U.S. Treasuries, big corporations, blue chip corporations like IBM, General Motors. And the only area that's risky in the money market mutual fund is when someone goes for the higher yield. They're looking at several different funds, and they go, oh, I'm going to go for this really high yield one. Well, guess what? That may be made up of commercial paper or riskier companies, and there you could take a little bit of a hit. But it sounds like, well, not sounds like, you say you are a cautious investor. My guess is that you're in a very broad-based money market mutual fund, and I would say that your capital is quite safe.
Great.
Thanks for calling, Eric.
Thanks.
My caller sounded really cautious this week.
I think that the long-term bear market is truly starting to have a toll on people. And the calls, you're absolutely right, the calls are changing. But I'm pleased. It's caution. Where there was a period of time, maybe 6 months ago, Stephanie, there was a lot of, do I sell, do I sell, do I sell? And, you know, it's anecdotal, selective, but it seems more, well, how do I construct a portfolio? How do I be a little more cautious? But it's less how do I get out of stock. So I think it's positive as opposed to negative.
Do you want to be on the show next week? Give us a call at 1-800-537-5252, or you can send us an email at mail@soundmoney.org. With grim financial news on so many fronts, what are we to do to protect ourselves and our finances? Eric Tyson says when it comes to your own employer, you may have more control than you think.
You've surely heard the recent tales of woe of companies engaged in massive layoffs and their stock prices simultaneously plummeting. In the worst cases, employees who have invested significant chunks of their money in their firm's stock end up losing their jobs and holding deflated retirement plans. With a soft economy and war concerns, we don't need more to worry about. While we can't completely eliminate our anxieties about job losses and stock price plunges, we can take action to minimize the fallout from future corporate disasters. When considering a job offer, thoroughly review the company's benefits package, especially the retirement plan investments. Be wary of plans requiring a long-term holding of too much company stock. I don't have a problem with investing some money, say 10 or 20% of your 401k account, in your employer's equity. Unless you can truly withstand the risk, I'd stay away from plans and employers that require more significant amounts being held in company stock.
This isn't about showing your loyalty and faith in the company. It's about avoiding a foolish and dangerous lack of diversification. No one in the executive suite is going to shed tears about you losing your job and retirement dreams. And even if they did share your sorrow, it's not going to bring your job and investment money back. Protect yourself and diversify. Seek out independent reviews of the other investment choices in the company's retirement plan. Give preference to broadly diversified mutual funds and avoid individual stocks and sector or industry funds. Try evaluating the company's culture, value system, and the management team's ethics. It's natural to avoid asking tougher questions when you're trying to get a job offer. But once you've gotten an offer, take the time to speak with numerous people at your prospective employer. Ask them what they like and don't like about the company, and what kinds of people fit in best and what types don't. Also inquire about the ethical standards, expectations, and behavior of senior management. Take off your rose-colored glasses and be open to the possibility that the company isn't the right place for you, even though you've gotten an attractive job offer. The more informed and careful you are before signing on, the better the position you'll be in to deal with the inevitable setbacks. For Sam Money, I'm Eric Tyson.
Eric Tyson is the author of Personal Finance for Dummies. Even though we've been hearing that the economy is on an upswing, the stock market continues kind of a lackluster performance. And Chris, you think that we should turn to J.P. Morgan for some advice?
Well, Stephanie, one of the most famous exchanges in the history of finance took place a century ago. An aging J.P. Morgan, the most powerful financier in the world, testified before a House committee. The committee was investigating the tentative web of financial interests that dominated the economy. J.P. Morgan's inquisitor was Samuel Untermeyer, a tough corporate lawyer.